This is The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we're speaking with Sarah Danzy-Jones, CEO of Applicant Pro, a software firm that simplifies the hiring process for companies. Applicant Pro has thousands of customers across the country, was recently named number 25 on Mountain West Capital Network's top 100 list. It was in the top one-third of Inc.'s list of the top 5,000 fastest-growing startups in the nation. Sarah took over the helm of CEO of Applicant Pro last fall from its founder, Ryan Kohler, who stays on as the company's chief innovation officer. All of that is quite impressive, but before we talk with Sarah about Applicant Pro, we're going to explore another important topic. The topic's women in technology, or more accurately, the lack of women in technology. Sarah is the co-founder of the Women's Tech Council, a community of about 7,000 members that is actively engaged in supporting and encouraging women to enter and thrive in the tech industry. Sarah Danzy-Jones, thank you for joining us today on The Bottom Line.
I am thrilled to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Great. So let's start. You and I have both seen, we've talked in the past, and we'll talk about how you and I got introduced later, but you and I have both seen fairly shocking reports on how underrepresented women are in technology. Can you share a few of those stats with our audience?
Well, I don't know specific numbers, but in my career, I've been in tech for over 15 years, and the dynamic is more like this, which is when I talk with a tech executive about the women at their company, they will say, there's a lot of women at my company. But then when you dig deeper, most of them are in entry-level roles, customer support, marketing, HR, and there's very few middle managers and then even fewer women in executive roles. That's the typical norm in, you know, a lot of tech companies that I see.
So let me share a couple stats, and depending on the report you look at, they're going to vary. If any of them are off by a lot, let me know, but I think they're fairly accurate. In technology, specifically coding jobs, less than 6% of active coders are women. I mean, that's really shocking. There's only a handful of publicly held technology companies that are led by women. And unfortunately, the problem's getting worse, not better. If you look at the percent of computer science graduates that are female graduating today, it's lower today than it was 20 years ago, which is really surprising. It's alarming, actually. Why do you think those trends have continued over the last 20 years, and why do you think the numbers are so, frankly, awful?
There are so many dynamics that go into
that,
but let's talk about a few
yeah.
of them, because, you know, I have been talking to so many people about this problem, and unfortunately, there's not just one right answer, right? Because if we could figure what that is, we would see those numbers start to increase dramatically. You know, I think a lot of what happens in life is how we talk about things and the image that we're able to paint for our young children around technology and what it means to be a technologist. One of the ways that I like to talk about technology is that there's so many pathways to get there. And if we can help to broaden those pathways of getting there, I actually think it creates a lot more entry points. And I think one of the challenges is that a lot of people have felt like there's only one small entry point, computer science, and that to do that, right, there's this kind of image of what it means to go into computer science, have a computer science degree, and the way you end up doing after you have a computer science degree. And that image is, of course, of the geeky programmer. And so changing that culture and changing that image for all of our young people, not just women, but the boys as well, there's a lot of work to be done
there.
It's
really quite shocking, right? I mean, it's glorified this kind of antisocial image mm-hmm. of what somebody in technology is, and it's surprising to me. I mean, that's what it was when I got my undergrad, unfortunately, you know, 30 years ago now. That's kind of what the image was, and it's actually gotten more stereotyped that way. Although when you look at the people that are in the technology jobs, as with any stereotype, you find that it's not accurate at all. Why do you think that stereotype has persisted? Because I think it causes a lot of damage in several ways.
Sure. I think it goes back to the stories that we tell when we tell the story of someone we knew, right? We tend to kind of, you know, blow that up or reference something that we've seen. For example, movies. How do movies portray people in computer science? How do they portray, you know, women or minorities, right? And when you portray those type of images to the masses, overcoming those images, it's really hard because then you have to kind of attack it one by one, where you've had like a movie like War Games, right, shown to millions and millions of people of what a really brilliant hacker kid looks like.
Now, half the audience doesn't know War Games. I'm old enough that, yeah, the War Games was a really cool movie when I was out there.
That's right.
A nerdy one. Also, some of the tech icons, Bill Gates kind of fits that image. Steve Wozniak, super nice guy, but also kind of fits that image. But for every example we can name of an icon that fits that image in some respects, there's somebody else, like Larry Ellison. He's a tough guy, but he's a really cool guy. I mean, he windsurfs and, you know, he does all these amazing sports. He's a very driven guy. Steve Jobs, you know, does not fit that stereotype. There's examples on both sides, but the stereotype persists. And I'm frankly surprised it does, because I don't think that it helps the industry. And if my career was coding and technology, I'd be kind of pushing back and say, why do we always get portrayed as geeks in the movies?
Well, I think, though, that, you know, the people I've spoken with, they actually don't mind being portrayed as a geek, right? Because it indicates you're smart, you're special, you have a knowledge base that other people don't, you're unique. And so and it's funny, when I do talk to men who program, sometimes they say, I don't want to be seen as super smart. Like, what I do is just, I just know stuff because I've learned it. But for some reason, everybody, when I tell them I'm a programmer, they think I'm super, super smart. Well, here's the thing, just human nature. I have an engineering and a law degree. Do I like it when people think I'm smart? Of course I do. I mean, who doesn't, right?
Sure.
And so, the challenge is,
but that's
it's not
the full definition.
It's not
Sarah
the full
Jones.
Definition, right. But it's also not a super negative stereotype either. And so it's not like I'm going to work really hard to unbreak, when somebody thinks I'm, you know, XYZ, and those are tend to be generally positive, I'm not going to do a lot of work to try to undo that.
So generally positive, but bringing it back to the issue of women in technology, I have two daughters. This is an issue that's very important to me. And for my two daughters, that image is a negative, and I, as their father, actively work to find cool people that can be role models and say, look how cool STEM type careers can be. Do you think that that's typical overall, that stereotype has a negative association in general for women? And maybe it's part of the force that's causing women to say, I don't want to be that geeky person. It's not who they have as in their mind, their image of who they're going to be in the future.
Yeah, I do think it does affect whether or not they're going to pursue some type of career there, because, or even pathway or any interest, because I think generally just we don't want to be unusual, right? It takes kind of the unusual personality that's willing to kind of step out of, you know, the box and say, I'm going to take a pathway that's different. My career pathway, I have always felt different. I have always felt like I've taken an unusual course that not everybody's going to take. So I have just kind of gotten comfortable with, okay, I'm going to be different. Now, when you say to the masses, to all these girls in high school, college, hey, it's cool to be different, that is a hard message to give them.
To
right?
a teenage girl,
to
absolutely.
To a teenage girl, exactly.
What do you think some of the other issues are when you look at the funnel that are, and we're going to talk about the different stages, but the first stage is really women choosing early in their lives to major in a STEM-related field. I saw a survey. Do you know Sunny Washington? She's CEO of a company called Arjusat, which is bringing STEM education to K-12 companies.
Yeah, Sunny and I are actually really good friends.
That's great. I'm a huge fan of hers and what she's doing. She had a presentation, and one of the slides in her presentation showed like, two-thirds of girls going into high school want to pursue a STEM education when they get out of high school. And it's like only 15% when they come out wine. So when you think about it, we're losing three out of four of the, if you think of it as a pipeline, there's four girls going in want to pursue STEM. At the end of high school, only one out of four want to. What do you think's going on there?
Their minds are on other things. I think there's a few things going on. Honestly, I have the highest respect for educators and the people who teach our students. I spent 3.5 years at an educational technology company, and I got to film the best educators in the country. And it's amazing to watch an amazing educator, fantastic educator that just really is passionate. However, I do think the people that are teaching our students right now have not had a lot of real-world experience. I mean, they went right into education in their college experience and then right into a school. So, you know, as a practical matter, they just have not been exposed. So even a guidance counselor, if a student says, hey, I'm thinking of doing a STEM degree, that guidance counselor cannot talk to them about, here's the 20 different things that you could do with that degree. They might be able to show them one or, you know, look on a website or the, you know, Bureau of Labor Statistics and say, well, if you get a degree in this, then this is what you can expect. And even the Bureau of Labor Statistics does not describe engineering as interesting, fun, creative. You know, it's pretty boring if you go to that website to look up what would it mean if I get a computer science or a computer engineering degree.
And let's pause there, because the reality is these jobs do have a tremendous amount of creativity. It's a different type of creativity than somebody that paints on a canvas or makes a sculpture. But my undergrad's in engineering as well. And that was one of the things I liked. I had a lot of freedom and there was a lot of creativity. In fact, you and I share a similar undergrad. We'll talk about it later, chemical engineering.
Yeah.
But you're right. Society, there's another stereotype that these technology jobs are not creative. And certainly in coding, incredible creativity. And you don't even have to buy the art supplies. I mean, it's all on your – once you buy the computer, those are basically all your costs. So it's very low cost to be creative.
I agree with you. I think that somehow we have missed how to message to these students what it would really look like. I don't know that educators know how to do that. I mean, schools are horrible at marketing in general of whatever they're doing. That doesn't mean they're not great educators, but helping them paint the picture of what would it look like past this, and then tying it to something that the students care about, right? The students care about kind of this immediate thing, what's going to immediately gratify whatever they're focused on. And it's hard for us to say, well, 10 years in the future, you could be doing this. That just doesn't connect with them. It doesn't resonate. And so we've got to find a different way to talk to kids about what it really means and looks like. And typically what I try to do is connect it to creativity, connect it to problem solving, or not problem solving per se, but how can you change the world, right? Because we've got so many kids that are socially minded in this generation that want to know that whatever I end up doing, I'm going to have an impact. So if you can connect to those things that our millennial generation really cares about, and I heard a funny statistic that millennials are actually turning 30 years old, which frightens me, tells me how old I'm getting. So I don't know what this generation in high school is actually called. I don't know if there's a term for them, but finding a way to make them care about it and seeing that potential from the perspective that they're at right now.
Those are really good thoughts. You know, you mentioned guidance counselors earlier, and we had Clint Betts on, who's the editor, the founder of Beehive Startups. You're wearing your Start SLC t-shirt today.
Yes.
Friday's a little more casual for me. I almost wore my Start SLC t-shirt today as well.
That would have been awesome.
That would have been great. And we had Clint on as a guest back in December before Start SLC, which was just this amazing event. They really did a great job. One of the things Clint talked about with us is and I talked to him about the issue of women in technology and specifically what Start SLC was doing to help promote that. And I think they did a lot of things to do that. But one of the stats that he shared with me, or data points, is at least back in December, the Utah school system, when you looked at job descriptions, described software development as a job that would be atypical for a girl. Did you notice that? Does that atrocity continue to exist, or has that been corrected?
Oh, for sure. And I'm actually the one that noticed that and brought it
good
to his attention
you.
Because what it actually says is this pathway is non-traditional for females, which is a term that I heard when I was in high school. And I graduated in 1992. So they're still using a term over 20 years later in these industries, right? These are you know, pages that are sent to high school kids and their parents to decide which classes to sign up for. Well, the other thing that is on that list is this career can be high-paying, in demand, and, oh, I can't remember what the other word, but there was like two or three things. And I thought, well, gosh, what girl wouldn't want a career that's high-paying or in demand?
Exactly.
But then they're told in that same list it's non-traditional for females. So, you know, every challenge that I've made
to
the state
board.
We need
to burn those pamphlets that have that and print new ones. Is that still being handed out in our schools?
It is. And I brought it up a couple of times to the state board. And unfortunately, it's not going anywhere. They're unwilling to change what it says on these documents. And I brought it up twice now and been pretty vocal about it. And it's unfortunate that this is what I'm talking about. There's a disconnect between the education system and what is being told to our students who are very influenced by
this. This is surprising to me. I thought it was an oversight that somebody says, oh, you know what? We haven't updated that in 10 years. Thank you for bringing that to our attention. We're going to update it tomorrow.
That's what we were hoping.
that is crazy.
No, apparently, you know, it's a deliberate decision. And
there should be no jobs, in my opinion, on that list that says it's non-traditional for boys or girls.
I completely agree with you. I mean, you know, if the percentages are going down, and actually if the percentages of students overall is going down for technology and engineering, then we need to re-message the way that we're talking to our students about it. But I just think that the education system really struggles with knowing how to do that.
So let's broaden. We were talking about the painting the image of a funnel, and it starts, you know, in the education system and what careers people choose out of high school to pursue in college. What about for the folks that do decide to pursue technology? Unfortunately, the stats are no better. In fact, I would say they're probably worse. For whatever reason, the technology field is not inclusive. It's not a friendly environment for women. And what are some of the things that make it less friendly for women than other fields once somebody that has decided to pursue STEM gets out of college and starts their career?
That's a great question. And I think there's two sections to that. So maybe we should talk about what happens at the university and then maybe what happens when they actually get into industry. Because I think it's a separate set of issues.
Great. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. So at the university level, I got extremely lucky. I'll just put it that way. I got into this group called Access Women in Science at the University of Utah. And the summer before I started my engineering program, I spent the summer with 24 other women who were also getting degrees in STEM. So I started out my engineering career with a group of friends. So when you go into college, right, it can be intimidating. You're out of high school now. You're a small fish in a big pond. And sticking with a STEM degree is incredibly difficult. And so more mentorship needs to be there. With Utah specifically, though, if anyone's interested in this issue, they should go look up Susan Madsen's research on women and education and the crisis in Utah, which is more women enter college in the state of Utah than men, but fewer women graduate. So we just have a general problem overall in this state of women actually completing their post high school education. There's so many factors that go into that. I don't want to spend time, but I do think that it would be worth people's time to go and check out that research, right? Because if women are being told something else, but they want to do a degree, but they're feeling pressure from other areas to do something else, that is a very ambiguous time for a woman, right? And so them sticking with whatever pathway they choose, even if it's not STEM, it's incredibly hard in Utah.
If you're just joining us today, our guest is Sarah Jones, co-founder of Women Tech Council and CEO of Applicant Pro. So you mentioned the support group. I don't know if that's the right term or not. My wife in business school, there was a support group for women, and she would point to her saying that made business school much more enjoyable for her and made the experience much more positive for her. And she would use the term support groups. I hope that that's okay that I do. That's something that's very simple to implement. And I love that because I think a lot of these solutions are not, big government programs. It's being sensitive to the issues and thinking about what's some of the low-hanging fruit that we could implement next week, next semester, and get them going. Within college, one of them is my term, focus support groups. What are a couple other things that we could be doing in the technology majors in universities to make it a friendlier environment for women?
So I think, let me just say in Utah, I do think there's an older generation of professors out there that subtly message to the women that perhaps they shouldn't be there. And it's really unfortunate. And I have friends that have decided to leave, challenging majors because they were told that they didn't belong. And that's always unfortunate, right? Because these professors have a lot of influence. And so I do think that the professors need to take that responsibility seriously of making sure women feel included and that they have mentorship that they need. Now, there has been some studies on confidence as well with women. And men and women exhibit lack of confidence differently, right? So men sometimes overcompensate. Right? This kind of, they put on this awesome shell. Right. And it's hard to tell if a guy is feeling unconfident. But honestly, in my experience, both men and women feel unconfident. But if you put a woman in an environment where they're surrounded by mostly men and they're one of the few women, it takes a pretty confident woman to kind of withstand that type of dynamic. It doesn't mean that she's not confident, but she's got to find a way to get the resources, the help, just like the guys are able to get resources and help. But there's got to be a mechanism for them to feel okay asking questions or getting help on homework or filling in those learning gaps if they're not getting it, because they won't stay if they don't have a way to keep learning and succeeding.
Yeah, resources help, and we all want to feel included.
Right.
And there's multiple studies that show, you're not gonna feel included if you're different than everybody else in the group. And the positive and the encouraging part of these studies is you don't have to get to 50-50. You really have to get to about a fourth or a third, and then all of a sudden, whatever that difference is, whether it's race or gender or whether you're an athlete or not an athlete, all of a sudden, if you get to like a fourth, a third, that difference kind of goes away.
Well, I'm going to challenge that just a little bit, and let's take it into the industry phase, because I have been in situations where there have been a critical mass of women, and yet the culture is not welcoming to women. And a lot of that has to do with, again, that dynamic of lots of women at the bottom, a few women in the middle, and hardly any women at the top.
Yeah, I think it can't be stratified. That exactly. Sense of inclusion has to go throughout the organization.
That's right. The integration has to be there, because if there's not a top down, the women, that are entering, if they can't see at the top that there is representation or meaningful, lip service is not enough. But when I say representation, what I'm assuming exists is that there's meaningful value being derived from the women at the top, that they actually can have impact, voice, and influence at the top. And when that exists and the woman can visualize and know that they belong in that organization, that's when you're going to see the difference. But from what I've seen, organizations who are content to, have lots of women at the bottom and just assume that that is going to keep women in and keep them growing and keep them progressing just are a little bit clueless in that area.
So before we leave this point, I do want to mention Jackie Zahner, who you probably know up in Park City, one of the youngest. I think she may have been the youngest female partner ever at Goldman Sachs, youngest female to ever make partner in the trading group that she was in. That was a really, really tough environment. Just a remarkable woman. She's the one that shared that stat with me about you don't need to get to 50-50. It'd be great to get there or above, but you get there slow. You get the benefits accrue to the company much sooner, which is nice to know. So we've kind of transitioned to organizations and what companies can do. And I want to share a brief story about how you and I met. We had interviewed a young man, Wesley Smith, who's a brilliant coder and programmer and was running a boot camp. And his vision was to have an accelerator, which helps companies learn business and coding skills so that they can go out and be more successful startups. And his idea really flips that whole model on its head. It's usually you teach people that already know how to program, called hackers, you know, really good programmers. You teach them business skills so that they can succeed. Wes's hypothesis and question he wanted to see answered is, what if we taught business people how to code so that they could build their own minimum viable product? They're already comfortable talking to customers. They're already comfortable with sales. Let's teach, in their case, the missing skill is coding. And that's going on right now up in Park City. Wes recruited me to help him with a lot of that. I'm his lead donor there. And I reached out to you because it's important to me in this program that it is welcoming and accepting to women. And I share this because you gave me some great advice early on. And so we'll start with the lessons learned, so I'm not pointing the finger at anybody else. First thing you told us was our messaging was really difficult for women. And the way our program was structured would make it difficult for women. So share a little bit about, this is an intensive course, share a little bit about what was off in our messaging that would make it more accepting to women and why it was tough for women to say, this is a program I want to be involved in.
Well, I appreciate being open to my feedback, first of all. So it's always great. Nice
yeah,
to
have somebody who we were completely off base, and just our hearts were in the right place, but right. We just didn't know how to think about it the right way.
Yeah, and I think that's generally the case with most people. So I think basically it came down to this. When you are trying to message to women, the more barriers or the more perceived barriers that it seems that they will have to take, the less appealing it becomes, because they're typically trying to balance a lot of things that are going on in their lives. And so whereas you might drive men that way with a really big, you know, opportunity type of message, women typically want to just make sure they can fit it in with whatever else they have going on and that it's achievable. They don't necessarily need, you know, a really strong message. They need something that tells them, this is going to be worth spending my time because I'm competing with so many other things. So what you've got to do is prioritize it for the woman so that they can manage it, you know, get it scheduled or whatever in their minds so that they're willing to put that time and effort into it because they're just, I mean, they're busy, but I find that they're less willing to sacrifice other things to make certain things happen. Whereas, for example, Startup Weekend or Start SLC or any of these things that go on for 2 or 3 days, men are much more willing to sacrifice that time than women, which is why you see very few women at these events.
Because if it's all or nothing and you're taking a whole weekend away from your family and your other commitments, that's a tougher trade-off for women. And I wasn't aware of that. And in our case, too, we were making it we wanted the application process to seem, frankly, a little daunting because we wanted people to self-select. But we didn't want to self-select out a whole group of people. So that was incredibly helpful for us. And the nice thing for us was the changes that you had recommended. One, you know, have an open house that's only 30 minutes. It's after work. Somebody, you know, lower the commitment. Somebody can come and explore it, find out more. You know, that was really easy for us to do. And frankly, every one of the candidates that ended up applying to the program came through that suggestion. If we had not talked to you ahead of time, we would not have had a single female applicant. In part, we just didn't know. We had purposely made the application process seemed difficult because we wanted people to have to put in several hours to even apply, and we made it seem very competitive, which it was. You know, the good news is we had about 25% of the applicants in our case ended up being women. A third of the people we gave offers to ended up being women. As you pointed out to us, the program is not – the way it's currently structured is not – particularly it doesn't fit into a lot of women's schedule. And we're gonna think about that later. But we ended up, fortunately, having one woman accept. So initially it would have been like 20% of the class. The class has since grown. But there are things we're thinking about for the next one that would say, does it take this much commitment away from home, or is there a way to do some of it at home? But I want to circle back. The point of all this is a lot of the changes are not like you've got to do these huge Herculean efforts. It's just being sensitive, aware, and wanting to have a better outcome.
I really appreciate you bringing up the self-selection process, because that ties into so many of these dynamics of why women aren't making it to the top. They are self-selecting themselves out. And it's because, you know, business, and also, let's say, if you are looking for that next step in your career, you have a job opening. Typically, what people are doing is they are putting every single requirement they would like to see in a candidate. And how women read that is, I've got to have every single one of those requirements to even apply.
Where a guy would say, I've got 3 out of 10. I'm going to apply and see what happens.
Exactly. And there's been so much research around that. And I think it's just being sensitive to the way women generally think. Now, that's not the way every woman thinks, but if you are running a company or if you are interested in trying to get more women into these pools, I mean, let's be honest, when I see a job, or, you know, I've hired tons of people. If I can find somebody with all of those requirements, be it man or woman, man, I feel like I found a unicorn. But I'm going to be pretty satisfied if I can find someone that has most of those or is willing to learn most of those. And I think the question we have to ask ourselves is, are we creating this situation where women are self-selecting themselves out because we have made it just unreasonable for what we're looking for in that next step? And possibly because we're seeing so few women at the top, that might be a big factor in that.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more with Sarah Danzy-Jones, co-founder of Women Tech Council. Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we are speaking with Sarah Jones, co-founder of Women Tech Council and CEO of Applicant Pro. So let's start to transition now into some of the solutions. The Women Tech Council has an award that they give out every fall to an individual, a woman that has made a difference in the technology field. This last fall, for the first time, instead of an individual, it was actually a company. It was eBay. Why did eBay get such an accolade? Why were they selected for that award?
I love the Women Tech Awards. It's my favorite event of the year. And the reason why is because there's such a lack of visibility of the success stories that are working. And I think it's so important for our community, especially in Utah, to see what's working. So eBay is a great example of a company that the importance and the prioritization of diversity, it actually comes from the top. And that is critical. So John Donahoe has strongly messaged and verbalized why it's so important to have a diverse workforce. And they're one of the tech companies that I believe works hardest at it. So not only does he verbalize it, the senior vice president of HR, she also verbalizes it. They also fund it, right? So they have a full-time role that actually that person's job is to drive diversity within the organization. And then they all also allow grassroots efforts for their employee base to also come together and to suggest ways and to bring this change about. The other thing I think they're doing right is they have both women and men participate in diversity initiatives. And a lot of organizations kind of relegate the business of dealing with quote-unquote women's issues, unquote, to the women. And that is kind of an old-fashioned approach. It will only make so much impact. And, you know, frankly, it's a little bit lazy. Right, because it actually takes more effort to bring men and women together around this issue.
Yep.
And so eBay happens to be one of those companies that does, you know, highly encourage men to get involved and participate, and it just creates a win-win situation. So I think their statistic is 23% women. I don't quote me on that, but it's the highest in those large tech industries. I know HP, Google, Yahoo, they all recently released their diversity statistics, and eBay rises to the top.
You know, that would one of my classmates at Stanford is the co-founder of eBay back in 1994 and 95, Jeff Skoll. And that would warm his heart. You know, he's no longer actively involved in the company, but it would warm his heart to hear that. And I'm sure he has heard that. He was always, even as a business school student, very inclusive, very sensitive to the needs of others. So thanks.
Well, and too, it should be mentioned that eBay had a woman CEO for a time, right?
Wasn't sure, Meg.
Megan?
Yeah. Meg
so,
Whitman.
Yeah. I think that makes a huge difference.
Who, if I'm not mistaken, we all associate Meg Whitman now with eBay. But if I'm not mistaken, she came out of the toy industry. So there was probably an example when the search went on that there were definitely some boxes of what they were looking for that Meg probably didn't have. But fortunately, she tossed her hat into the ring, and that's a nice success story.
Yep.
So we're talking about some solutions that companies can do. I want to kind of go back up the funnel now and talk about some solutions. So like for high school girls, for instance, I'm familiar with Girls Develop It here in Salt Lake City. I want to kind of share some names of resources. Parents out there that want to get their kids excited about STEM, what are some resources that they should know about? Girls Develop It is one that focuses on women and helping them learn to code. So that's obviously a very inclusive environment. What are some other resources?
Oh, this is great, and I hope I remember some of them. Cody Henriksen at the Canyon School District runs a summer girls coding camp, and he would love to have it filled with girls. So I will let him know that I'm talking about this on the show, and gosh, anyone can join. It's not just for Canyon School District, and he does a fantastic job, and he's so passionate about this. So another group that I think does a great job is the GREAT, G-R-E-A-T. It's a robotics and coding camp during the summer that the University of Utah does. I wish I had girls. I would send them, but I do send my boys there every year. Also, Utah Geek Events does a number of family-centered and community-centered coding events. And let me think if – so you got Girl Develop It. Okay. If I think of any others, but those are kind of the ones that I would love to see
email
supported.
Email them in, and we'll put it on our website, which is kcpw.org. Great.
Oh, I remembered another one. Okay. I need to mention. Helen Hugh at Westminster College. Helen has done – she's been phenomenal at changing the state of Utah and getting programming to count as a graduation requirement. And you're going to be shocked that it didn't. As of last year, it only counted for math, but it did not count as a science graduation credit. And so now it does, and thanks to Helen. Nice. But Helen also runs a summer camp. I don't know if it's just for girls, but she is so passionate about this. And she's also creating a program for more high school teachers to be able to teach programming in the high schools and to actually create a curriculum for them and to educate more so that more of our high schools will actually have programming classes.
Yeah, and for parents out there, I'm actually 50 years old. I'm taking a coding boot camp now. It is completely doable. I think 30 years ago when you had to code on a mainframe, it was really difficult.
Right.
And it's every year it gets easier, but it is completely something. Putting together a cool website is something that's completely doable for any kid, I think, over 12, certainly, and for talented kids, maybe as young as 10. So, and it's fun. So encourage your kids to do it.
Well, I think, too, parents need to just not underestimate what their kids can learn. I mean, my 8-year-old, and don't put me in parent jail here, but he learns a lot from YouTube. And the other day he was showing me a programming technique with HTML, and I have never sat down and taught him HTML. But he showed me how he can go in and inspect an element on a website and change, you know, a character to make it display differently on the website. And it's just, I just think kids have this amazing ability to learn. So I let him spend time on Scratch, which is a great entry level.
That's another good resource.
Right. It's very visual.
It's a graphical coding developed by an MIT professor, if I'm not mistaken.
And it's wonderful. And I will have, you know, if he wants to choose to do something, I'll say, okay, you can have three choices. And one of them is spending an hour doing Scratch, and you can do whatever you want. And he did his own graphical with music, graphics on it all by himself. I didn't touch a single keystroke. Kids are amazing. I think more parents would be honestly surprised at what their kids can do.
Yeah, I think toss them in a little bit over their heads and see what happens. And we're there, of course, as a safety net if it doesn't
That's right.
go well. If you're just joining us today, our guest is Sarah Jones, co-founder of the Women Tech Council and CEO of Applicant Pro. So in our breaks, I've been mentioning kind of casually that you're, oh, by the way, you're also the CEO of Applicant Pro, which is quite a substantial company. I think it's, I looked it up, 5,000 clients in just about every industry. It is focused on the in the HR space. Let's transition now, if it's okay, and talk about your role as CEO of Applicant Pro. Could you share with us a little bit, just share with the audience, what does Applicant Pro do?
Sure. I joined Applicant Pro about 6 months ago, was asked to be the CEO there, and we do an end-to-end hiring solution. So any company who hires frequently typically is advertising their jobs. They're typically looking for different sources and then trying to find ways to make their HR person's life easier. And so that's what we do. We can take any paper process that people are usually using, and we can convert it into a central way that the HR manager can just manage all applicant flow, any source that they're getting applicants from. We can help them advertise. You know, it's funny, I've learned so much about the HR industry, and, you know, search is such an amazing tool with hiring. And so we've learned all sorts of techniques onto how to actually better optimize your job ad to make sure that it gets found, right? I mean, everybody in the country is competing for talent. And so there are techniques that you can use to be able to make sure that your job is found and that you can get in great candidates. And then we have the integrated, once you find the candidate, you want to be able to filter down. So assessments can be a huge part of that, so that you're only seeing candidates that might be really great for your position. We also have integrated background checks and all the way to paperless onboarding. So that's what we do.
And, you know, we mentioned earlier, it was started in 2005, if I'm not mistaken. The founder's Ryan Kohler.
That's right.
And Ryan, you know, it's really hard to grow a successful company. You know, 80%+ of companies like this in the early days don't survive, right? It's a great idea. Execution is really hard. He had to develop the technology for it. Did a great job building that base, and decided, I've got a quote here somewhere that, He was interviewed by Silicon Slopes, and he shared that he likes waking up every morning not knowing where he is going, which is has a lot of enduring qualities. But when you're leading a team as your company gets bigger, there's a place for that, right? It allows you to opportunistically go where the opportunity is, but it also makes it hard when you have 5,000 clients to strategically plan. Now, he has decided he's staying on at the company as the chief innovation officer. And that's what I want to talk about is, were you worried about that going in? Hey, the two of you are still going to be there. You're taking over for a founder. And if you were worried about it, what were some of the things that you were concerned with? And now 6 months in, what has proven to be the challenges and what has proven not to be a concern?
That's a great question, and I should probably just mention for the record that we have over 3,000 clients, just so I don't get in
Thank
trouble
you.
With
okay.
my marketing team, but which is an exciting, it is an exciting milestone for us to be at 3,000. But you're right.
They say your first 3,000 is the hardest, so you'll be at 5,000 before you
we
know.
We will, that's, and we're super excited to get there. We continue to grow at about 70% a year as a bootstrap company, which is really great growth. And, you know, I'm going to be honest, I really approached this as just an amazing learning opportunity. When I met Ryan, and the way that he thinks very differently, outside the box, you know, and there's just so many people that just tend to kind of go toward, you know, kind of the group think. And he just does not think that way. And I just thought this was going to be an incredible opportunity for me to learn firsthand from a tried and true entrepreneur, and that the way that they think and approach problems. And it's not that any of those problems went away when I joined, right? We're constantly having to problem solve on a daily basis how we're going to deal with certain issues. So it's really fun for me to work with him on a daily basis and see, well, how does he approach this? How would I approach this? And then how do we get to the right solution? And so for me, you know, I think a lot of people might have gone in with a lot of trepidation. Maybe I'm naive. I don't know. But it for me, because I've approached it as a learning experience, maybe some of the, you know, quote unquote control issues that maybe a lot of people might be worried about haven't been a big concern for me, because I feel like as long as we have an open dialogue about whatever the issue is, you know, we can kind of resolve everything on the front end. I think the big learning experience for me just over the last 6 months is just making sure that we understand what our complementary strengths are and that we're just utilizing those to the fullest degree. He has a set of skills that is amazing. He's brilliant, right? He can deep dive into a situation like nobody else I've ever seen. But I also have this other set over here, that's very group oriented. I can understand context, and then I can understand implications, ramifications as I think 3 months ahead of where do I want this decision to end up. Not that he can't think ahead, but I'm just saying that we approach things from a slightly different angle. I think we have a mutual respect and admiration for each other's strategic abilities, and that together should combine into a really strong team. So to his credit, he's running this company, building it up to 3,000 clients as a sole founder, really. And most people at that point, honestly, I mean, Doug, you've seen enough of the industry to know they would have built a huge executive team by then. And so he had a really great management team, but really acting as the only executive, it's a lot.
Let's say with the management team would also come a board of directors. Now, he's bootstrapped, so he hasn't been forced to have a board of directors. Like, if you take venture capital money, you're by definition going to have a board of directors. So how is the governance of the company done? Is there a board of directors with outside viewpoints, or is it's not atypical for a company that's been bootstrapped really to have the founder and then some people that he has close personal relationships, typically friends, on the board? How is that governance structured?
So we don't have an official board,
which actually makes
it nice, as you can imagine.
Nice in some respects, harder. A good board should make it easier.
Agreed. And so, we have considered putting together a, informal advisory board. But I think between the two of us and the contacts he's been able to gain in the industry, and then I can bring a second set of network and contacts and advisement from the outside. I think together that makes a pretty good group of people. He's also on the board of Screeny, which is a company that exists in Mexico. And Screeny does video hiring. And so he's on the board there, which is a funded company. And so he does get that perspective as he's interacting with those folks on kind of how a funded company or a board might perceive certain business issues.
I'm curious. There was a Salt Lake City venture capitalist, Paul Ahlstrom, that went down to Mexico.
Him.
Is Paul the venture capitalist behind Screeny?
He is.
That's a small world.
Yeah.
Small world. And there's also a competitor to Screeny right here in town. We had him on the air, Mark Newman, which is HireVue.
Yes.
As I said earlier, the secret is in the execution, not in the idea. So several folks have the idea and they're executing it different ways. One of the things I was impressed by, and I forget where I saw this, but just the makeup of the team that you inherited at Applicant Pro. 70% of the team is women. And as we talked, it's not enough just to have that number. It depends on where the women are. But sales is critical to any startup. And 85% of Applicant Pro's sales force is women. Was that a conscious decision? And what were some things that Ryan was doing early on to make Applicant Pro the type of company that would be comfortable for women to work at?
I would say that Ryan did not consciously set out to hire a lot of women. And so what's amazing about this whole story is that a lot of people assume that somehow I had a role to play in that. And I have to remind them, no,
I
inherited this. And so, when a lot of people, assume that it's not possible to create a tech company, a SaaS-based company without a lot of women and kind of have this, create these mental barriers for themselves, I just point to Ryan and say, well, he did it. And he didn't assume that women were able to, or competent or, able to do that. So it's actually nice to be able to share this story to a lot of other people to break down some of those myths. There have been a lot of people in the company. And what he's just found as he's tried to perfect the business model is that I want to be clear that we actually use assessments pretty strongly at our company. And so we look at our top performers and we assess them and we say, let's go hire more of them, right? I mean, it's just kind of business logic. It's makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense, but there is a stigma attached with that. Mm-hmm. And I saw an interview that you did where the person asked you, did you have to take an assessment test? And sure enough, you did. had you done that before for in other positions where you had to take an assessment test? And going into it, what, did you have that stigma attached with it as well?
I have never taken an assessment to take to get a job until now. And it's not as if it was a real, you know, job requirement. I took the assessment because I was fascinated. I love assessments. I think it's, you know, there's not enough of, you know, high school or college kids understanding what their innate skills and strengths are and who they are at their core. I actually think it's a very helpful tool. So I've taken assessments all throughout my life. Typically, I've taken them at other jobs, but not until I've gotten into the job at some point. Never as a hiring tool. The nice thing about an assessment, just objectively, is, for example, if you were to line up Ryan's and I's assessment, we're pretty opposite of each other. That shouldn't scare anybody, right?
That should be what he was looking for.
Exactly. He shouldn't be looking for somebody that's exactly like him. He should be looking for somebody who's a compliment. You know, I'm extroverted. He's introverted. I'm group oriented. He's individual oriented, right? But on certain important things like assertiveness, independence, you know, drive, we're very similar, right? He's not going to want somebody that's super, you know, submissive or harmonious or can't make a decision. And, you know, and not that harmonious people can't make a decision, but just simply that he shouldn't want somebody that is exactly like him. He should be looking for other characteristics.
If you're just joining us today, our guest is Sarah Jones, co-founder of Women Tech Council and CEO of Applicant Pro. We interviewed 2 months ago, I think, Ross, I'm looking at our producer here, Parker Conrad, who's the CEO of a company I'm sure you've heard of called Zenefits, which is the fastest growing software as a service company in the history of the world ever. Just raised a major round that I think in 2 years got him to what's called unicorn status and above. HR is a really hot space today. 2005, when Applicant Pro was started, wasn't so hot. Why do you think HR software and why do you think HR is so hot right now?
I think talent is just becoming much more important to companies, right? I think the competitive landscape is so competitive of keeping your people and finding the right people. And I think everyone out there is scrambling and fighting for talent. And we're realizing that as certain things become commoditized, talent all of a sudden becomes like a major asset to your company. And if you're not a leader and you don't believe that, then you're probably going to lose because people are more and more an asset to to companies. And so I just think there is a need to find and keep great talent. I also think, though, that HR is one of those industries that's a little bit slow to adopt. So you're seeing now, and education was this way too. I mean, if you look at educational technology, gosh, about 2 years ago is when they just started, you know, VCs started coming in like droves. Education's another area that's slow to adopt. And so I think HR is one of those industries that a lot of people didn't pay attention to. And all of a sudden, now you're finding people like Ryan, who actually wasn't ever in HR, but he found a way to bring in a technology that is very, very helpful to HR people. And in industries where they are slow to adopt, typically, you know, there's not a lot of people knowing how to build great technology. And so it typically takes somebody from outside that industry to really figure out how to solve those pain points. And something Ryan is very good at is really getting down to what is the real pain and then figuring out how to solve the problem. Another situation where this is happening as well is legal, right? It's not the lawyers that are to creating technology. I'm a past lawyer myself, right? But it's not the law firms that are saying, gee, why don't we create a great technology that can make discovery a lot easier? What's happening is somebody from outside the industry is saying, gosh, I could figure out how to make that a lot easier. Here, let me figure out a big data, you know, strategy that can actually do the job better than your young associates that are sitting in this room doing data discovery.
My industry is another one that's just starting to get disruptive. I'm in the financial services, mm-hmm. Albion Financial Group. We're the to our knowledge, the largest independently owned wealth management shop in the state. And for many years, you know, my classmates at Stanford had no idea what I did. It wasn't an industry that was on the radar screen. I just had my 20th business school reunion a couple weeks ago. And there's a number of really smart, bright, energetic, talented people targeting financial services. So it's going to be really interesting to see how it evolves. As you mentioned, law's another one. So HR's hot. You guys were early movers. You have a 10-year head start on a lot of folks. Is your sense that there's a land grab going on now, and it's more important than ever to move quickly and to lock up these opportunities?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like you said, the idea isn't what's unique. It's how you execute. And so there's a lot of companies going out and trying to, you know, grab up clients. And for us particularly, we're in small, medium business. And so we're trying to, you know, grab clients that are about, you know, 1,000 to 2,000. Franchises actually can be much larger than that, but the individual franchise sites act much more like small businesses. Restaurants, right? Each of those act a lot more like small businesses. So anywhere that organizations are acting like small businesses or have resources like small businesses is kind of an area of interest for us, but there's a lot of competitors in this particular space.
And is your game plan to continue to be bootstrapped given the land? It takes money to grow oftentimes. So I don't know if capital is a constraint or not, but are you guys at the point now where you're thinking maybe now's the time to bring in some outside capital, or are you thinking you want to go it without bringing in any outside investors?
Yeah, for the present, we are not interested in outside funding. You know, there's so many ways, of course, to go about growing a company. And our chosen approach for right now is go get customers and then have them love us and have them stay, because they won't go somewhere else where they love. We only have 5% churn, which for a SaaS company is great.
It's awesome.
It's awesome. And that is due to, we've got a great support team. I mean, it's due to the team, really. And we've been able to do things in ways that other companies haven't. And so our chosen approach is to, you know, just stay the course and go and bring in companies, you know, and we're not interested in trying to bring 1,000 a month right now, right? Because that presents a whole set of other growth issues. We've built a process that works. We know that clients love us and then they stay. The other, you know, thing that Ryan's had the benefit of that maybe a lot of other people in the industry don't is this is actually the second version of the product. So he was able to test his applicant tracking system with a prior version. And then he just said, okay, now's the time to switch over and create a whole new one from scratch. But he had all of that learning under his belt when he built this one.
Let's take a quick break, and then we'll wrap up our conversation with Sarah Jones, co-founder of Women Tech Council and CEO of Applicant Pro. So I want to wrap up with two main questions. One is kind of your path. We mentioned it earlier, and we've talked about it briefly here. Your undergrad's in chemical engineering. It's not a major that a lot of people are going into these days to begin with. And it's also in my chemical engineering class, we had 500. I went to Purdue undergrad. Mm-hmm. 500 people started. 126 of us graduated. And we had two or three women in the entire class. Was that dynamic there when you were looking at your undergrad, and how did you look at that and say that's not how you'd like it to be, but it is how it is, and you decided you're going to embrace that anyways?
We had 6 in my graduating class out of 36 at the University of Utah, and I'm going to be perfectly honest with you that being a woman in engineering for me wasn't that big of a deal. And I actually think a lot of women that make it through an undergraduate program don't come out like highly concerned about the few numbers of women in engineering. And again, I think that's a little bit of naivety and just not knowing what we don't know. But I didn't come out with this burning like, oh my gosh, I was just one of the only women. It was actually a great program. I had a great experience. And one of the professors, Joanne Lighty,
I was going to mention her. For a while, I don't know if she still does, she was the head of the program.
That's right. So I had a female mentor, right? And so my security in being one of the few women in the program, it actually didn't highly concern me because I had access to resources resources. And again, I was part of the Access program. And so I kind of entered in with this high, you know, confidence level that I could be able to accomplish what I wanted to accomplish. And also, I'm incredibly stubborn. And so I'm going to finish whatever it is I set out to.
You know, it's funny you say that. My wife's an engineer as well.
Yes.
And she was okay with the education. My wife's Linda Wells. She went to Georgia Tech. She was okay, and she was one of the few women, mechanical engineering. But when she got out in the workplace, boy, she just found she looked at the world very differently than the people she was working at in a day-to-day basis. And we actually worked together. She found the work environment to be caustic. I found it to be really invigorating and exciting, and it's so just amazing the different viewpoints. Did you find that when you went out in the workplace?
Absolutely. It was, you know, and I gave a talk a little while ago for Women Tech Council, and the video is posted on YouTube if anyone is interested in seeing it. But I talk about the first time I realized how difficult it was going to be for me was when I got into industry and basically was told, why are you here?
She would say the same thing in a completely different state. I mean, she was in the East Coast, and then we also worked together in Tennessee.
Yeah. And that's so unfortunate, you know, because it sets the stage for women who are entering industry with this immediate question mark in their mind of, will I be able to succeed? And so when you think about that, it's no wonder that it's only the stubborn ones or the ones that are willing to fight the system. It's no wonder that they're the only ones that make it to the top. And so if we can really think about that and what that experience is like, and when I interview, you know, women for Women Tech Awards at the university level, and you ask them, what does it mean to be a woman in engineering where there's so few, they actually don't even know how to answer that question, because to them, they have not noticed a difference in how they're treated, and they won't until they get that first job, which is sad to me, actually.
It is. And, you know, that first job has to be more welcoming. I mean, as we talked about, and it's a great note to wrap up on, it's a complete funnel. Mm-hmm. And every stage in that funnel has room to improve. The good news is there's been some progress. The bad news is there hasn't been enough progress. And I use that as kind of a motivational closing point. For all of us, think about what we can do to be more sensitive, more inclusive. I think we as a society all win when we do that. So thank you. Our guest this morning has been Sarah Danzy Jones, co-founder of the Women Tech Council and CEO of Applicant Pro. Sarah, thank you for joining us this morning on The Bottom Line.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Today's show was recorded at the KCPW Studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. Thank you, Ross. You do a great job for us. You can hear my entire interview with Sarah on our website, kcpw.org. You can also tweet me, nicely please, at Savvy Wells or at KCPW Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.